dust pattern on the television. The Indian at the top of the screen glared as James carried first Lydia, then Nath, to bed. Then, because without Marilyn the bed felt too empty, like a barren plateau, he returned to the living room, swaddling himself in an old crocheted afghan on the sofa, and studying the circles on the screen until the signal cut off. In the morning, it all began again. Each morning, Lydia and Nath, finding themselves back in their beds, wondered for just a moment if the universe had righted itself. Perhaps they might enter the kitchen and find their mother at the stove, waiting for them with love and kisses and hard-boiled eggs. Neither ever mentioned this most tender hope. But each morning, when they met in the kitchen and found no one there but their father, in rumpled pajamas, setting out two empty bowls, they looked at each other and knew. Still gone. They tried to keep busy, trading the marshmallows from their cereal to make breakfast last as long as they could. A pink for an orange, two yellows for a green. At lunchtime, their father made sandwiches, but he never got it right. Not enough peanut butter, or not enough jelly, or cut crosswise instead of in triangles like their mother would have. Lydia and Nath, suddenly tactful, said nothing, even at dinner, when there would be peanut butter and jelly again. The only time they left the house was for the grocery store. "Please," Nath begged one day on the way home as the lake glided past the car windows. "Please, can we swim? Just an hour. Just 5 minutes. Just 10 seconds. James, his eyes on the rearview mirror, did not slow the car. "You know Lydia doesn't know how," he said. "I'm not ready to play lifeguard today." He turned onto their street, and Nath slid across the back seat and pinched Lydia's arm. "Baby," he hissed, "we can't swim because of you." Across the street, Mrs. Allen was weeding her garden, and when the car doors opened, she waved them over. "James," she said. "James, I haven't seen you in a while." She held a sharp little rake and wore pink and purple gloves. But when she leaned on the inside of the garden gate and peeled them off, Lydia spotted half-moons of dirt under her fingernails. "How is Marilyn?" Mrs. Allen asked. "She's been away quite a while, hasn't she? I do hope everything is all right." Her eyes were excited and bright, as if, Nath thought, she might get a present. "We're holding down the fort," James said. "How long will she be away?" James glanced down at the children and hesitated. "Indefinitely," he said. Beside him, Nath kicked Mrs. Allen's gate with the toe of his sneaker. "Don't do that, Nath. You're leaving a scuff." Mrs. Allen peered down at them, but the children, in unison, looked away. Her lips were too thin, her teeth too white. Under the heel of Lydia's shoe, a wad of bubblegum stuck her to the concrete like glue. Even if she were allowed, she thought, she could not run away. "You two be good now, and your mother will be home soon. Isn't that right?" Mrs. Allen said. She shifted her thin-lipped smile to James, who didn't meet her eye. "Our groceries must be melting," James said. Though he and Lydia and Nath knew there was nothing in the bag but a quart of milk, 2 jars of Jif, and a loaf of bread. "It's nice seeing you, Vivian." He tucked the paper sack under his arm and took each of the children by a hand and turned away, and the gum under Lydia's shoe stretched and snapped, leaving a long, dried-out worm on the sidewalk. At dinner, Nath asked, "What does indefinitely mean?" Their father looked suddenly at the ceiling, as if Nath had pointed out a bug and he wanted to find it before it ran away. Lydia's eyes went hot, as if she were staring into the oven. Nath, remorseful, prodded his sandwich with his knuckle, squeezing peanut butter onto the tablecloth. But their father didn't notice. "I want you to forget everything Mrs. Allen said," James said finally. "She's a silly woman, and she doesn't know your mother at all. I want you to pretend we never even talked to her." He patted their hands and tried to smile. "This isn't anyone's fault. Especially not yours." Lydia and Nath both knew he was lying, and they understood that this was how things would be for a long time. The weather grew warm and sticky. Every morning, Nath counted up the number of days his mother had been gone. 27, 28, 29. He was tired of staying inside in the stale air, tired of the television, tired of his sister, who more and more stared glassy-eyed at the screen in silence. What was there to say? Their mother's absence gnawed at them quietly, a dull and spreading hurt. One morning in early June, when Lydia nodded off during a commercial break, he tiptoed toward the front door. Their father had told them not to leave the house, but the porch steps, he decided, were still the house. At the far end of the street, Jack perched on his own porch railing, chin propped on bent-up knees. Ever since that day at the pool, Nath had not spoken to Jack. Not even hi. When they got off the school bus together, Nath tugged at the straps of his book bag, walking home as fast as he could. At recess, if he saw Jack coming toward him, he ran to the other side of the playground. It was starting to be a habit, disliking Jack. Now, though, as Jack turned his head and spotted him and bounded down the street, Nath stayed put. Talking to anyone, even Jack, was better than more silence. "Want one?" Jack asked when he reached the steps. Nestled in his outstretched palm, a half-dozen red candies, fish-shaped, the size of his thumb. Head to tail, tail to head, they glistened like jewels. Jack grinned, and even the tips of his ears perked up. "Got them at the 5 and dime. 10 cents a scoop." Instantly, Nath was flooded with intense longing. For the shelves of scissors and paste and crayons, the bins of bouncy balls and wax lips and rubber rats, the foil-wrapped chocolate bars lined up at the front counter, and by the register, the big glass jar of ruby-colored candy, the cherry scent wafting out the moment you lifted the lid. Jack bit the head off one of the fish and held out his hand again. "They're good." Close up, Jack's eyelashes were the same sandy color as his hair, the tips golden where they caught the sunlight. Nath slipped one of the candies into his mouth and let the sweetness seep into him and counted the freckles on Jack's cheek. 9. "You'll be okay," Jack said suddenly. He leaned closer to Nath, as if he were telling a secret. "My mom says kids only need one parent. She says if my dad doesn't care enough to see me, it's his loss, not mine." Nath's tongue went stiff and thick, like a piece of meat. Suddenly, he could not swallow. A trickle of syrupy spit nearly choked him, and he spat the half-chewed candy into the grass. "Shut up," he hissed. You shut up." He spat again, for good measure, trying to expel the taste of cherry. Then he stumbled to his feet and back inside, slamming the door so hard that the screen shook. Behind him, Jack lingered at the bottom of the steps, looking down at the fish trapped inside his fist. Later on, Nath would forget exactly what Jack had said to make him so angry. He would remember only the anger itself, which smoldered as if it had always been there. Then, a few days later, the most wonderful distraction arrived. For Nath, at least. One morning, Nath turned on the television, but there were no cartoons. there was Walter Cronkite, serene at his desk, just as if he were doing the evening news, but it was barely 8 a.m., and his desk stood outside, the Cape Kennedy wind ruffling his papers and his hair. A rocket stood poised on the launch pad behind him. At the bottom of the screen, a countdown clock ticked. It was the launch of Gemini 9. Had Nath known the word, he would have thought, surreal. When the rocket shot upward in a billow of sulfur-colored smoke, he crept so close to the television that his nose smudged the glass. The counters on the bottom of the screen showed impossible numbers. 7,000 miles an hour. 9,000. 10. He had not known anything could fly so high. All morning, Nath absorbed the news reports, savoring each new term like a fancy bonbon. Rendezvous. Orbital map. Lydia curled up on the sofa and went to sleep, while all afternoon, Nath repeated, Gemini. 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 Like a magic spell. Long after the rocket faded into blue, the camera stayed trained on the sky, on the fading plume of white it left behind. For the first time in a month, he forgot, for a moment, about his mother. Up there, 85 miles high, 90, 95, the counter said. Everything on Earth would be invisible. Mothers who disappeared, fathers who didn't love you, kids who mocked you. Everything would shrink to pinpoints and vanish. Up there, nothing but stars. For the next day and a half, despite Lydia's complaints, Nath refused to switch to I Love Lucy reruns or Father Knows Best. He began to refer to the astronauts, Tom Stafford and Jean Cernan, by first name, as if they were friends. As the first transmission from the astronauts was patched through, Lydia heard only garbled, scratchy gibberish, as if the voices had been pressed through a grinder. Nath, however, had no trouble making out the words. Jean, breathless, whispering, "Boy, it sure is beautiful out here." NASA had no television feed of the men in orbit, so the station aired a simulation. An actor on wires, a prop set on a soundstage in Missouri. But when the space-suited figure lumbered out of the capsule and floated gracefully, effortlessly upward, feet to the sky, tethered by nothing, Nath forgot it wasn't real. He forgot everything. He forgot to breathe. At lunch, while they ate their peanut butter sandwiches, Nath said, "The astronauts eat shrimp cocktail and beef stew and pineapple cake." At dinner, he said, "Gene is the youngest man ever to go into space, and they're going to do the longest spacewalk ever." In the morning, as his father poured cereal that Nath was too excited to eat, he said, "The astronauts wear iron pants to protect their legs from the boosters." James, who should have loved astronauts, what were they but modern cowboys, after all, venturing into the newest frontier, did not know any of these things. Tangled in his thoughts, Marilyn's torn-up note pressed to his heart, he saw his son's new obsession through the other end of the telescope. The astronauts, far off in the sky, were mere specks. Two little men in a sardine can, tinkering with nuts and bolts. While here on Earth, people were disappearing, even dying, and others were struggling just to stay alive one more day. So frivolous, so ridiculous, actors playing dress-up, strung on wires, pretending to be brave, dancing with their feet above their heads. Nath, mesmerized, stared at the screen all day with a serene smile, and James felt a hot, resentful flare in his gullet. On Sunday evening, Nath said, Daddy, can you believe people can go practically to the moon and still come back? And James slapped him, so hard Nath's teeth rattled. Shut up about that nonsense, he said. How can you think about things like that when... He had never hit Nath before, and he never would again. But something between them had already broken. Nath, clutching his cheek, darted out of the room, as did Lydia. And James, left alone in the living room with the image of his son's shocked, reddening eyes, kicked the television to the floor in a burst of glass and sparks. And although he took the children on a special trip to Decker's department store on Monday to buy another, he would never again think of astronauts, of space, without recoiling, as if shielding his eyes from shards of glass. Nath, on the other hand, took down the Encyclopedia Britannica and began to read. Gravity. Rocket. Propulsion. He began to scan the newspapers for articles about the astronauts, about their next mission. Surreptitiously, he clipped them and saved them in a folder, poring over them when he woke up in the night dreaming of his mother. Tented by his blanket, he pulled a flashlight from under his pillow and reread the articles in order, memorizing every detail. He learned the names of each launch. Freedom, Aurora, Sigma. He recited the names of the astronauts. Carpenter, Cooper, Grissom, Glenn. By the time he reached the end of the list, he was able to sleep again. Lydia had nothing to keep her mind off the mother-shaped hole in her world. And with Nath distracted by docking adapters and splashdowns and apogees, she noticed something. The house smelled different without her mother in it. Once she noticed this, she could not stop noticing. At night she dreamed terrible things. She was crawling with spiders. She was tied up with snakes. She was drowning in a teacup. Sometimes when she woke in the dark, she could hear the creak of the sofa springs downstairs as their father turned over, then turned again. Those nights, she never fell back asleep again, and the days grew sticky and thick like syrup. Only one thing in the house still reminded Lydia of her mother. The big red cookbook. While her father locked himself in his office and Nath bent his head over the encyclopedia, she would go into the kitchen and take it down from the counter. At 5, she could already read some, though not nearly as well as Nath, and she sounded out the recipes. Chocolate joy cake. Olive loaf. Onion slim dip. Each time she opened the cookbook, the woman on the front looked a little more like her mother. The smile, the folded back collar, the way she looked not right at you but over your shoulder, just past you. After her mother had come back from Virginia, she had read this book every day. In the afternoon when Lydia came home from school. In the evening before Lydia went to bed. In the mornings, sometimes it was still on the table, as if her mother had been reading it all night. This cookbook, Lydia knew, was her mother's favorite book, and she leafed through it with the adoration of a devotee touching a Bible. The third day of July, when her mother had been gone for 2 months, she curled up in her favorite spot under the dining table with the cookbook once again. That morning, when she and Nath had asked their father about hot dogs and sparklers and s'mores, he had said only, "We'll see." And they all knew this meant no. Without their mother, there would be no barbecues, no lemonade, no walking down to the lake to watch the fireworks. There would be nothing but peanut butter and jelly and the house with the curtains pulled shut. She flipped the pages, looking at the photos of cream pies and cookie houses and standing rib roasts. And there, on one page, a line drawn down the side. She sounded out the words. What mother doesn't love to cook with her